And I have not made out of course copper, and I have not silver plated. Now, I wonder, I question, does silver plating do something that really I should really have, you know, achieved making these things that I lost because I just used straight copper dick? What do you think? What's the real story on silver plating and HF coils? Over.
I'm fairly convinced, Mel, that the difference is extremely minor at HF frequencies. You can go to the right book. Let's see. Theodore. I'm having trouble thinking of Theodore's last name. A book on microwave techniques where he gives you a formula for what is the skin depth of penetration for a radio wave, and it's a function of 1 over the square root of the frequency. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the skin depth of the RF energy goes down, becomes smaller and smaller. So at microwave frequencies, silver plating can make a measurable difference. But HF frequencies, the skin depth is so darn deep that it's very similar to a guy asking the question when I set up my 80-meter dipole and I made it out of 14-gauge household wire. Should I bother removing the rubber insulation? Will it make a difference in the gain of the antenna? And the answer is not one bit. The RF energy goes down through the insulation, the rubber insulation, and waits till it hits some nice solid copper before it does its thing. And so that radio wave doesn't see that rubber insulation you've got on top of the wire. Now, whether or not you leave the rubber insulation is a function of the extra thickness of the rubber insulation gives you more wind load and maybe more ice loading, although maybe it'll give you a slipperier surface so that maybe the ice won't stick, depending on what the insulation on the 14-gauge household wire is. And is it going to protect your copper wire from a little bit less oxidation? People also worry about the oxidation you get on the surface of copper wire, and that's only a couple of molecules thick, and the RF energy is going down to something close to a thousandth of an inch at these frequencies. So even if you took your dipole antenna, which has been out in the weather with bare copper, and it's got a very, you know, tarnished look to it, and you use Scotch-Brite or steel wool or whatever, or sandpaper, and sand it down so it's nice and shiny, and you think you're going to get more gain, absolutely not. You wouldn't be able to measure it with laboratory equipment. So your coils, as long as your biggest resistance of that coil is the way you make contacts to the end of it, the beginning and the end, and whether you smash the end and made a great big hole in it and got a great big large area where you connect it to the variable capacitor, that's where I'll bet you 90% of the resistance is. And you're worried about the resistance that the RF energy sees along the length of the coil. I don't think so. Now, in the case of the roller ductor that you've got in something like an ARC-5 transmitter, where there you've got to make a sliding contact as you roll that roller inductor, there silver plating, because of the sliding contact, in my opinion, is important. But as long as you make good contacts on the ends of the coil, I don't think there's even 1% difference in the performance of that coil if you did a perfect silver plating job versus not silver plating. And when you're silver plating for RF purposes, let me drop, it is very different than the silver plating you do for the silverware that you put on your table. Very different process. The silver plating that's done for microwave purposes is an art form plating on, plating some of it back off, burnishing in between, fancy chemicals and whatever, to try to get very well adhered, very fine grain size with electroplating of silver is a very difficult process. And so to make it microscopically smooth and a very desirable grain structure, the kind of silver plating that you do for silverware can easily have beautiful looking surface, particularly if you shine it, but microscopically it could easily have higher resistance than bare copper with copper oxide on the surface. Very difficult to do a very good job of electroplating. to get the same conductivity you would get out of a wrought bar of silver. So for a bunch of reasons, I recommend you don't worry about the silver plating. In the case of the very wide piece of strip line that's used on the pair of 4CX250B strip line amplifier, a number of people have done a very careful job of silver plating and making measurements before and after, and that's a 432 high power amplifier. They could not see any difference, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger. This is K2KEY. Well, they sell, you know, iMac used to sell that that material, that strip, you know, went around the outer ring of the tubes, that finger stock. I couldn't think of the word for a minute. The finger stock, and they silver plated. If you remember that finger stock used to come in long strips, rolled up, and you cut what you want and make yourself up, you know, the connecting rings to the tube. And they silver plated that, but I wonder. Yeah, well, I guess because, you know, it was supposedly very good quality and everything. But the reason I brought it up, because I made a couple of rotary inductors up, and I didn't bother to silver plate the copper. And I don't use a sliding contact on the coil as it's turning. I have actually a wheel. I came up with a method with a wheel and a little finger contact, so it keeps fairly tight. It's a whole machine shop job that I came up with for an improved rotary inductor. But I never used any silver-plated wire, Dick, over.
Now, the finger stock that touches the anode of a 4CX250B2, for that to be silver-plated, in my opinion, is a good thing. Because there you've got a very simple compression contact. And if you looked microscopically, a very small contact area is taking place. And so for that to be silver-plated, I think is a worthy thing. Because lots of oxide on those fingers making that very tiny contact could make a difference. I do know that the fingers you've got on the bypass capacitor of the socket on a 4CX250B, those fingers are also silver-plated. And if you plug a tube in and unplug it a very large number of times, as I did when I was testing a bunch of tubes in that amplifier, and you rub away that silver plating, because there's such a fierce amount of current, like something like 45 RF amperes flows through those capacitor finger stock contacts on that screen grid of that tube when you're using it at 432. Such a high amount of current on 432 flows through that those finger stocks at lower frequencies is much, much lower current. Because the current that flows through there is a function of the voltage and the frequency between the plate and the screen grid. So I've had this situation happen where the finger stock became rubbed clean of the silver plating, and after plugging a tube in and running it for a while, I found out that the tube had welded itself into that socket, into some of those fingers, because they weren't making real good contact. So where you've got compression fittings, I think silver plating and sliding fittings, I think silver plating is appropriate. But other than that, at HF frequencies, I don't think it's required. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW.
More or less agree with that, because I could never see anything, you know, with whatever tests I were able to perform, if there was any, you know, really improvement or any difference at HF frequencies with silver-plated coils, etc. But, of course, you know, if you mentioned it, and if I haven't said this, on, as you say, on 75 meters at night, discussing this, they'll say, oh, boy, you hear it. Oh, you hear things, I mean, as you said, with the wire. How many of them on 75 meters will tell you that you see how much improvement you'll have on your antenna, your loop, if you change over from number 12 gauge to number 10 gauge wire, that it will improve the performance of your loop antenna. So this is stuff, I mean, that goes on and on and on, but when you question it, you know, they turn it around on you and say, well, you don't know anything. You don't know what you're talking about if you're questioning. So I stay away from those subjects, and I just leave it here for the tech net. Over.
Sounds good. Yeah, there's lots and lots of opinions. A significant number of those guys will tell you that each UHF connector gives you half a dB of loss at the VHF and UHF frequencies. The quickest way you could confirm whether or not there's any loss in that coil, Mel, is to run the transmitter key down for 10 minutes. Turn up the transmitter, open up the case real fast, and touch that coil. You've got to worry about whether or not portions of the coil are being heated by the air coming off the anode of the tube or the heat of the anode of the tube that it's in direct contact with. You've got to evaluate that one, so to speak. But there is, from my point of view, no loss mechanism that the conductivity of that coil could have, which wouldn't show up as heat. And even if the coil did get hot to the touch, that might represent 1 watt of dissipation for 10 minutes. And 1 watt out of 100 watts that you're running through that that circuit is an extremely small percentage. You know, it's 0.01 dB, so to speak. And would that 1 watt of dissipation be any different if it was silver-plated? You could run that experiment. To really measure the insertion loss and power output would be very difficult because you don't get the exact same voltage out of your Con Ed wiring two tests in a row, so to speak. So there's too many variables to make the direct measurement. But you could make the very potent indirect measurement by putting a thermometer, one of those non-contacting type thermometers, and actually measure the temperature of the coil itself under working conditions. That'd be a fun experiment. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Let me tell you something. When you would go key down, like for instance on that Collins rig with those ceramic tubes, it warms up the radio room real comfortable in the wintertime. Oh, it's a pleasure. The amount of heat that comes pouring out of that system. They got a blower down in the bottom that is huge in the power supply. I mean, this is a big blower, and it has a pipe that comes out the back, a 3-inch flexible hose that goes up to the head where the tubes are. And they got a high voltage cable comes up, you know, it's a whole thing there with the power supply. To give you an idea, the power supply on the Collins weighs 175 pounds on its own, Dick. So you can you can imagine the amount of heat that this thing throws out if you were to go to something like operating AM or key down, over.
That 175-pound power supply, Mel, is that for the Collins transmitter that runs 1 watt? Or is it the one that, 100 watts, or is it the one that runs a kilowatt? Go ahead.
And that's the kilowatt. That's the KWS-1. The actually, the power supply is meant to hold up one end of your desk. It's about 36 inches high or so, whatever desk size is, 33 inches or whatever it is. In other words, that's how it was originally made. You have one side of the desk was hung on, sat on the top of this thing, and the other side was drawn. And then the whole head of the rig sits on your desk. It was a whole layout that they built up with the console and everything, and the price this thing goes for with the console and all, with the receiver and the transmitter today is ridiculous. A tremendous amount of money that you could buy. I'll say buy yourself a comp to what these rigs go for today. But the construction on that power supply, especially in Collins, oh boy, they over, you know, do it because the component quality and the ratings is phenomenally high. That's why, well, they were delivering them to the military. So, you know, they said, well, whatever you do, you're not going to destroy these radios, over.
A KWM-1 kilowatt amplifier in good operating order today being sold on eBay. What's your guess? $15,000, $20,000? And what was the actual rectifier tubes in there? Were they 866s, Mel? Back to you.
I have no idea what they're going for, but I heard all kinds of prices. Depends on what you got with it, you know, because I could say complete console and And you have the receiver, the matching column 7584 that went with the KWS-1 and the station control console. And there was a few other things. There's a microphone that was the, I think they call it the FM-1 mic that Collins had for that. And, yes, the original rectifiers in there, 866s. Nice old, glue, the nice glow, that beautiful blue glow in those tubes. And when you talked in there, you watch it modulate and everything, so... You should see the way that thing is constructed with the, when you open up the front door of that power supply, it's got a shorting bar that comes down, a mechanical shorting bar that makes sure the capacitors are discharged. It's got the interlock and all kinds of things. It's just to sit there and look at it, how the tubes are actually, the back panel where the tubes, the rectifiers sit into, is actually a Bakelite panel, Dick, over.
Was that a full-wave bridge rectifier with four 866? And by the way, for those who have never seen an 866, this is a tube that stands, about 8 inches tall, probably around 3 inches in diameter, mercury vapor rectifier with a plate cap coming out of the top, anode cap. And when they were doing their rectifying job, that mercury vapor inside gave them a very low voltage drop and a nice blue glow that was proportional to the current flowing through the tubes. So as you AM modulated that rig, you would watch the tubes glow brighter and dimmer during the portions you were speaking into the microphone. Exciting to watch. Were there four of those tubes in there, Mel, for a full wave rectifier? Go ahead.
Just two tubes. Power transformer has many taps on the tube. Gee, you know, you're amazed that those 866s are root of a tube. They were used, like you say, in many power supplies of World War II vintage, and even after World War, there was a lot of World War II, there was a lot of them around surplus. So those power supplies were really cherished by the hams who started building, you know, big amplifiers. So nothing wrong with those 866s. They really do work still quite well. I did replace them. I put in 572s, which is the replacement. And as far as that was my, when the first time I ever saw that, I went to a ham that had, you know, big rack of equipment, of a big home-built transmitter, and he had a glass window and on the power supply, so you could look in there and actually see the 866s. And, was I impressed by that, Dick. I was just flabbergasted when I saw that in operation, over.
And now you own one of these systems, isn't that true, Mel?
Well, the KWS-1 doesn't have any window. You can't see those mercury rectifiers when the front door is closed. That's a solid door, Dick, over.
But this guy that you were talking about, he had installed the window so that you could see them?
Oh, he had a homebrew rig. It was all homebrew. It had a big cabinet sitting there about 6 feet tall, you know, the AM rigs that these guys put together from surplus parts after World War II. So he had the power supply, you know, with a window, and then he had the final amplifier that you could look in there, and he had a pair of, my God, what was those tubes in there? 4-250s or 4-400s? You know, remember those big old bottles, over?
Sure do. Have you ever seen a rig with 813s running full blast where the anodes, these carbon anodes, would glow? Go ahead.
Oh, I own one. I still got it. It's laying in a closet. When I finally started getting into high-powered rigs, that was mine. I bought the 813s for 25 cents a piece or whatever. I think it was, you got four for a dollar or some goddamn thing or whatever the heck it was. Brand new. There were tons of them, you know, with the sockets, with everything, the caps. You know, and surplus markets at that time in the 50s was so full of stuff. So I built, that was my first big transmitter, as you would say, was a pair of 813s, and sure, always made them. I just fit it up, but aha, they're glowing nice and red in there. Ah, now it's putting out power. Those tubes would take a beating. God knows how much I pushed them to, Dick, over.
What is the proper plate voltage and screen voltage for an 813? Is it around 3,000, 3,500 volts on the plate and maybe 400 on the screen? Go ahead.
Now you could have put anything. Some put 3,000. I heard of guys putting 4,000. They were putting whatever it was. You just, like I say, you couldn't destroy the tube, literally. And if you did, yeah, you always had a bunch of spares. So the 813, it was a brute of a tube. And it's funny that all that stuff fell by the wayside. You know, we came up with, like, replacement tubes now, the more modern rigs today that are still using glass tubes, such as the 3-500. And yet, I still say that stuff like a pair of 813s, I think, would do great. What happened to them? Why did they stop manufacturing? I understand. I believe in some broadcasting systems they're still using 4-400 to take over.
Yeah, some of these tubes have still got some very good service left in them. And 813s look to me, the quality of that tube looks to me like it should have been, by modern standards, $500 a piece. And I think you said you were getting them for 25 cents a tube with the socket. Wow. Man, was that a deal. I guess an awful lot of them were coming off of military service. That's why they were being sold so cheap. Go ahead. And maybe you want to go to the next letter. It's your choice.
Okay, to say the final words, then. What happened was they cleaned out warehouses. There was so much in the warehouses of those tubes that they didn't know how to get rid of them already, literally, other than throwing them in a garbage pail. So what happened was that they were selling them in New York, Cortlandt Street, Canal Street. I'll never forget, I see a tube there that later on became somewhat popular, but when they came out, they were selling them, was a tube called the 304TL. And the way it was sold, brand new, it came in this crazy-looking thing. It was actually hung in space in this triangle, in this square rectangular box-like. It was like just four corners of a piece of wood. And then they were, it was tied together. The tube was actually suspended in the middle of this cube. I guess you'd actually call it a cube, and then wrapped around with some kind of canvas. That's how they shipped that tube, and they were selling them brand new like that for a dollar a piece. Dick, called the 304TL. I'll never forget that. The cube was about, oh, I'd say about 18 inches square, and the tube hung suspended inside there for shock mounting it, so it could get to its destination in one piece, over.
With that method of mounting, it sounds like you could drop it 6 feet on the concrete floor without damaging it. Did that 304TL have a pin that came out one side of the glass? Mel, go ahead.
No, it had two pins coming out of the top. I know the one you're thinking of, that was not the 304, the TL. I think that may have been the 204 TL. Actually, the 304 or 404 TL, actually, that's what they did. They took that series, they put four of them in there. There was four tubes, actually, in that tube, Dick, of that series. So they took the single 304, I forgot what the heck, no, what was the number of it originally? But they took that, and they put four of them inside. So you looked in there, you saw four actual tubes inside of it, over.
So you're telling me four tubes inside of that envelope. Oh, amazing. What frequency was that useful up until, Mel?
No, it was three. It was 304TL or 404. No, the 304TL was three tubes in there. What was it used for? I believe that they were making them for radar. I think it was made for, I'm almost positive, it was for World War II radar. I think radar operating around 2 meters, if I'm not mistaken, Dick, off the top of my head, over.
And were those pins coming out the top, the anodes, and running in some kind of a push-pull circuit, VHF push-pull?
Well, I don't remember, but
frequency, what they wound up, a number of hams, I think, wound up using them as the audio modulator. And yeah, I believe they went into the AM modulator circuit, the 304TL. And I don't remember too many circuits around that they used them in RF circuits. I can say it got very foggy to me. It's so many years ago. But that was one big, nice-sized bottle. I think it was around, it may have been about 8 inches in diameter and stood about, could have stood 8, 10 inches, 10 inches high. It was a big piece of glass. And you looked at it, you thought, God knows what the government must have paid for them. But, boy, they sure were a lot of them on the surplus market over.
What did the socket look like, and what's your guess as to the plate dissipation in watts of that tube?
You know, I have to look it up, really. I don't remember that. The socket looked like a socket. It was a round socket. It had a big ring, I remember, on the back, at the bottom of the tube. It was like a perforated ring on the bottom. I don't know how to describe it. It looked like a band going around the bottom of the tube with a lot of holes punched into it. Can you picture that, over?
I sure can. I've seen a bunch of tubes like that. Sure, it sounds like a fancy bottle. And I guess guys had a lot of trouble, a lot of fun building rigs around those. Maybe better go to the next letter, Mel. KQLIW.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, the surplus days. I happened to have a very good connection into surplus in those days. So I had a lot of fun with it. Oh boy, tons of stuff. You'd go mad. If you would have been around those days, I would have taken you to this place with surplus. You just would sit there like, for us hams, you would sit there and just, cry, literally, watching what they were doing to transmitters and stuff. I mean, I just took what I needed, but I was able to take anything I wanted because the guy who owned the place happened to be a personal friend of us and the family. So anything I needed, meters and tubes and things, they were breaking it all up, just tearing everything apart, busting it all up for aluminum paneling, for whatever scrap value you could tear out of these things, and all the tubes were just smashed to pieces, meters, everything. Most of the brand new equipment just being chopped to pieces with sledgehammers and all, and just used for salvage, and it was coming in by the truckloads. So you can imagine what you would see, variable capacitors and things and coils, everything just being smashed to pieces. It was, to this day, I get tears in my eyes, Dick, over.
And I guess at the time, even if you put it out in bins on the floor of the store, of the surplus store, not enough people would buy it, so it was not worth the time, is what I think you're saying. Go ahead.
You went down to Cortlandt Street, and you went with a $5 bill, you could carry home what you'd get. I mean, some of the stuff they were selling was strictly being sold by weight, whatever scrap weight was going for, in iron or whatever, because they were just stuffed. Their stores, their surplus, a few surplus places on Cortlandt Street, they were stuffed from top to bottom. They were the old buildings. They had a store downstairs and loft up above them, and you couldn't walk into the places, literally. I mean, they were so packed in there because they were emptying out these warehouses, like the Brooklyn Navy Yard and everything. They had warehouses because what had happened, the contracts just continued because what was really thought that World War II would not end until around 1948, that there had to be an invasion of Japan and whatnot. And so the war would drag on at least a number of years. So the contracts just continued. They were still making those ARCs, those ARC-5s and everything after the war over.
So the contract didn't get canceled soon enough. And the previous contract, in other words, there's a whole lot of stuff still in the pipeline is what I think you're describing. And so that's where an awful lot of the surplus came from, the stuff that was still in the pipeline. What a flow of material. What an effort that was, that war. Sure made an impact on the rate of development of transmitters, receivers, and radar receivers, and antennas. When you read that series of McGraw-Hill books called the Radiation Laboratory series, which I think were published in 1949, you get a little bit of a feeling of how fast those developments took place for that war effort. Any other letters do you think we should be reading, Mel? K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, just one final word. I'll never forget a truckload came in, and what was on there, do you remember, you know, because I just saw a reference to it, I think, recently. There was a thing called the frequency meter of World War II that they used for checking frequency called the BC-221. These were all brand new ones. They were packed up with the charts and the different attachments and things. Brand new ones. They must have had 150 of them. I took at the time, I'm still taking 25 of them. I gave them, bit by bit, I gave them away. The guys used them for CFOs and whatever. But you can imagine, I got one put away. I just happened to think of it. A BC, brand new BC-221. I got it in original, as it's originally packed, Vic. Pull here. Do you remember the BC-221 frequency meter, over?
I think it was a heterodyne system where you had a number of standard crystals, and you would listen to the appropriate harmonic of one of those crystals and beat it into a receiver and listen for the zero beat in order to measure the frequency. Was that approximately the way it worked, Mel?
Now, so well made, Dick. The construction, the cabinet, and all the way the door, the front door folded down, and inside there was a little door that you opened up, and there was the calibration chart. Pages and pages of calibration so that you could check with the dial settings. And I'll tell you, and they had the, like you say, they had the reference crystals. And it just the look at this thing, you'd say, how can you throw a thing like this out? And I thought maybe someday you'd take a look at this, you'd see what the workmanship that went into this thing. And I saw them, how many. I took a number of them, like I say, the rest of them were just pounded into junk. So, I don't know. I just guess I should stop thinking about those days, but... I had a lot of fun with that stuff, Dick, over.
I can tell you did. And it's hard in a situation like that to know what's going to be valuable and what's not going to be valuable. You could easily fill up your salads with something that you'll never use, and vice versa. A year later, you'll say, boy, I wish I had picked up two more of them. Now that I know what they are, boy, are they valuable. Sure, you ran into both of those situations, right, Mel?
Well, I filled up the basement where I lived with my parents. I filled up the basement bit by bit with surplus. More and more kept coming in. I kept everything I saw. I'm taking this and I'm taking that. Well, they put their foot down because the house started to stink. I said, no, this is like perfume to my nose. I still got a carton load of surplus plastic. And I open up that carton every so often, take a sniff of it, so it's... That smell brings back some memories. But when you went to Cortlandt Street and any of those surplus places or whatever, you smelt that whatever the heck they used to spray all that equipment with, if you remember, over.
Yeah, I think some of it was packed in cosmoline, some kind of a grease to make sure that things don't rust. And in those days, I vaguely remember visiting New York City, going to Cortlandt Street, Canal Street, Greenwich Street, and there was just row after row of stores with bins that you would walk through and find pieces of surplus equipment. I think a certain amount of theft took place, but a certain amount of it, I think they almost allowed it to happen because it brought customers into the place. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Funny you should bring that up. A friend of mine owned a surplus place in New York. Yeah, that smell was they sprayed... the chassis inside, you know, the bottom underneath the chassis where all the capacitors and resistors and everything with this anti-mildew stuff, so it's gone to the Pacific and all the, it wouldn't start to deteriorate. The wiring and everything was this waxy smell, stuff that smelled terrible. I mean, to most people, except to me, of course, they sprayed the whole bottom of the chassis with that. Now, in New York, he had a place on Cortlandt Street, and, he had barrel loads of stuff in the street. In the front of the store had barrels of all kinds of junk, I don't know, pieces they ripped off, you know, stuff like lots and lots of capacitors and resistors and insulators and things. These were barrel loads of them that came out of places that were, you know, had, these are all brand new parts that they never used for assembling of equipment, but the contract finally did stop. What are you going to do with these barrels of stuff? So he had these barrel loads, that, you know, they look like 50-gallon wooden drums loaded with it. And at night when he closed up, he'd leave it out there. I'd say, they're stealing those seals. Who knows? He says, who cares? He says, I got another 30 barrels of it laying there. He says, they'll do me a favor in taking some of it away, over.
Wow. So he wanted people to take it away. What a different world. When did you first start seeing 4CX250B tubes? What year?
Anyhow, so, you know, somebody came by and they were honest person during the daytime and they picked out a part out of one of those barrels. It was barrels of crystals. Oh, I'll never forget the crystal barrels. Looking for crystals that was, you know, for the handband. Most of them were some crazy frequencies, but yeah, that's when guys started grinding crystals. Because you could take those crystals, you remember parts, take the screws out of the front cover and the crystals would be taken out. So we had barrels of those crystals, and you never see anything like them. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of crystals in a barrel. So you start digging through people standing there. And if someone said, oh, Eureka, I found one for 80 meters. I found one for 40 meters. And they go inside, and take 25 cents. If you walked away with it, well, what the hell. But when did I first start seeing 4CX250? You know, they started to come down, and there started a whole ton of them come. Where the heck? They were pulling out of equipment, and somebody I knew came one day with them, and he says, yeah. Well, he says, what do you do with these? And he must have had about a dozen of them. I don't remember. I'm trying to remember what year, Dick, over.
Well, Collins started using them in their rigs. Also, I think the FAA was pulling them out of all of their transmitters every couple of months. They were, you know, not putting very many hours on them. I think they would use 20% of the life of the tube and then replace them. And that was the, you know, the mean time between failure of the tubes. And all those tubes would last two or three times their predicted lifetime. So you bought a used 4CX250B for some ridiculously low price in the 1960s, and you never had to worry about them wearing out as long as you didn't abuse them. How about you, Mel?
You know what a lot of them were used, where they became more than the ones that were being pulled out of the FAA. I believe there was a gadget. I don't know what it was used for, but I remember them marked for RF heating systems, over.
That makes some sense. Probably some kind of drying or heating of an industrial process. Go ahead.
That's where a lot of them came out of, that were being produced. They started making them also by the tons, and they started showing up at surplus places. And I remember when the price of them went to, you know, literally some of them looked, and they were brand new ones, a lot of them, and they were $5 a piece, okay? I saw them, I had bought them, I think, as low as $1.50 a piece, picked over.
Yeah, I've seen prices like that for 4X150s and 4X250s. And when it comes to using RF for heating purposes, that really got started in 1945 with a guy named Percy Spencer. He's a man who worked for Raytheon, and he is accredited with being the guy who invented the microwave oven, because he stood in front of a magnetron tube that was in operation at the Raytheon company in 1945, and the candy bar in his pocket started melting, and he said, what's causing that? And so I think it was around 1948 that the first Amana radar range microwave oven became available, approximately 1948, 1949. I remember seeing one of those in a store that was near my home in Farmingdale around 1950 or so. So RF heating, people suddenly discovered what you could do with that. Not many people know that name, Percy Spencer, the inventor of microwave oven. Just like not very many people know the name of the man who invented the Xerox process. Back to you, Mel. KQLAW.
KC2FYJ, question or comment?
Go ahead, Harry.
Comment, actually. I have a vague recollection of seeing a copy of QST from back in the 60s or 70s. I guess it was the 70s, late 60s or early 70s, in which they were talking about using a garbage can with a couple of electrodes in it, an anode and a cathode, and using it as a microwave cavity of some sort. And they had a thing where they had to cut a hole in the side of it, and you could put stuff in it and cook. I don't know if it was an April Fool's issue or if it was real, but I have this very strong recollection of having seen that article in QST back in the, as I say, the late 60s or early 70s.
Yeah, the April or May 1972 issue, one or the other, had a great big galvanized garbage can with a rod going into it to be used as a 2-meter resonator, high-Q resonator. And that wasn't an April Fool joke. That was a real one. I don't remember seeing the one where you cut a hole in the side and cooked food. But it sounds like a fun project. And, have to keep an eye out for that particular article, Harry. How back to you, Mel.
Yeah, well, what were you cooked in there? You stuck a Frankfurt in. That's what it is. It was a hot dog. I remember that. It's ridiculous. That the guy was making his hot dog inside there, Dick, over.
And a galvanized garbage can is very easy to make a resonator on 2 meters. So do you think it was a 2-meter transmitter that was cooking the hot dog, Mel, go ahead?
Yeah, definitely, right. In fact, that's what I said. There was a number of tubes that were developed for World War II that was when radar was on 2 meters. Actually, that's approximately the frequency. This was, 2 meters. Oh, my God. Where? 144, 145 megahertz. You know, you were talking about extremely. This was, I guess, the ultimate high frequency of the time, Dick, over.
Not too far after World War II, the very first moon bounce took place with a radar at Fort Monmouth. And I think it ran at 120 megacycles, a great big phased array. Looked to me like it was about 20 feet wide and 20 feet high, the steerable phased array. And I think the first moon bounce was done on roughly 120 megacycles. Mel, go ahead.
Definitely. Like I say, they developed, I think that's 304TL for radar use during World War II. It was driven by, if you remember, the lighthouse tubes that they came out, the 2C39s. Which I saw for years. There were a lot of 2-meter rigs that you could put together, and even I think they could go as high as 70 centimeters, if I'm not mistaken. I guess you're more familiar. Remember the 2C39, Dick, over?
Absolutely. I've used a lot of 2C39s. They were a popular ham tube for 1296. The Airborne Instruments Laboratory made something called the Model 125 Power Oscillator, used a slight variation of a 2C39, the ceramic version, and that power oscillator, I think, went all the way up to either 1,500 or 2,000 megacycles. Mel, go ahead. Triode tube.
Exactly. That was the lighthouse tubes that they developed. Of course, there was a lot of work being done, in that different experiments. And of course, there was a number of radios that were very unique at that time. I think one of the most fascinating radio I saw was when they attempted to started trying to miniaturize things a little bit more. And the forerunner of the so-called miniature tubes that came out after World War II, which of course became very popular for portable radio use. But during World War II, if you remember the Acorn tubes that came out, now that was they were all in the 900 series, 920, 940, 955. Those little Acorn tubes with the pins sticking straight out, those little tubes that were only about a half inch high. So That was all being now going towards, you know, like you say, trying to get up there higher in frequency. But once you got up around 100 plus megahertz, you were really up at, as I thought, maybe at the, not much closer to what was achievable ever in theory, over.
The first guy who set up a Sirius radio telescope, the 32-35 foot diameter dish by Groke Reber in Wheaton, Illinois. He made a homebrew receiver where the local oscillator used those Acon tubes, 935, and he was very disappointed about the fact that the noise figure of his receiver, and he didn't know the word noise figure in those days, the sensitivity of his receiver was such that he wasn't seeing very much sky noise at roughly 1,000 megacycles with that great big dish. It wasn't until he came down to lower frequencies that he was able to really map the sky. But he was doing it with Acorn tubes. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, that was, like I say, I have a few of them around. Very interesting, the concept of how they were going, trying to get more into supposedly towards the end of the war, the amazing amount of experimentation, how much it leaped forward in 5 years of the, you know, electronics, how radar went from unknown to its sophistication by the end of the war, that they're ready to have radar aiming guns and things like that and whatnot, you know. It was just phenomenal. And of course, even towards the end of the war, you know, like you say, you were talking about 120 megahertz boom bounce was really an achievement. So, yeah, it's amazing in our lifetime, Dick, how far we came. It's just mind-boggling, over.
And those first radar pulses off the moon at 120 megacycles with this 20-foot wide, 20-foot high, roughly a 400-square-foot phased array, flat plate, so to speak, steerable Azel antenna on a great big pedestal at Fort Monmouth. I think they were running numbers like 20,000 watts peak envelope power for those radar pulses to get a moon echo. Nowadays, guys can do moon bounce with one Yagi and 100 watts and the right kind of a computer program on 2 meters. We've come a long way. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, nice reminisce about having been able to grow up in the time, and actually we grew up at the time, we were right at the right time being born, that we were able to see a lot of, you know, the progress that was made a few years before we were born, and then lived through the progress that really came through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and, you know, up to the present. So we were a very unique generation, Dick, that we've had experience, which, of course, a lot of the hams, you know, start to question me, what was this, what was that, what's that, and what's this, you know, about, how do you remember all these tubes and things? I said, well, that's what we lived and breathed for so many years, over.
And you think that we live through exciting times. The modern-day kids could also come to the conclusion they've lived through modern, exciting times. They've watched jet aircraft do some very exciting things. They've watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon. They've watched the development of cell phones and computers, and the cell phones getting more and more powerful and smaller and smaller, and integrating cameras and global positioning satellite receivers and portable digital assistants and whatever. From their point of view, they live in exciting times. The technology, as I see it, and the rate of development, Mel, is not slowing down. If anything, it's speeding up. And so we're not the only guys to live in exciting times, as I see it, Mel. Go ahead.
No, I embrace the new technology. I love it. Believe me, I appreciate it. I put the laptop computer down here, and amazing what it'll do. I'm just saying that I guess, you know, growing up in a time, I sort of, you know, enjoyed punching chassis and mounting sockets and plugging in tubes and all that kind of stuff. It was a time that you could really have a lot of fun for very little, you know, and if you were interested in electronics, building things, lots of kits around, like Eastkit and Heiko, and, you know. So, to me, that was, you know, really an error that they can't experience. That's the point, Dick. We experience, but you can't convey to them really what it was really like because they haven't lived through it, over.
Understand. What is the current status of the Ryan Visitor Center at Floyd Bennett Field? Is there a chance they'll be through with the renovations so that you guys will be able to go back there again next June for the field day site? Go ahead.
Known as a total mess. It's a disaster. They tore the place up and all, and I don't... Last time I was there, I didn't see very much in the way of progress being, you know, in renovating it. So I'm very doubtful. You know, when the government gets involved with things like this, that it's going to be a long drawn-out affair. As far as I was concerned, they didn't have to tear that place up like that. That place was not in that bad a shape. It needed, yes, it needed some upgrading upstairs and all and some other things, but to do what they did there, tear up everything like that, I just question that, but what can I say? We had nothing to say about it. So it looks like we're not going to be there for quite a while, Dick. I have a feeling it'll be years before, and even when it's completed, I don't know what the situation will be with it, because supposedly it's only going to be a museum, and whether or not they'll open it to club activities or whatever, or other activities other than a museum, I don't really know, over.
When they began the renovation process, although they may exceed their schedule, is there at least a stated schedule that it's going to be completed in 1 year or 2 years? Was there anything stated like that? Go ahead.
Nothing whatsoever. I asked some of the people that are in charge there for the Parks Department, because, you know, it's all under the Department of Interior now, Parks Department. And I asked them, you know, one of the park rangers, I know a number of them there that have some authority, and I said, so, when, where, who knows? They said, we have no idea. We don't even know, you know, when they work, and, you know, what the procedures are, anything. It's like, you know, it's like right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing, literally, Dick, over.
Who do you believe is financing the renovation? Go ahead.
It's under the Parks Department, Department of Interior, I guess, out of Washington. They're all coming out of Washington. They're the ones that are in control of the whole situation. In other words, it's going to be it's designated now as a park, you know, a U.S. park. Basically, it's officially not a field anymore. It's called Floyd Bennett Field, but it's officially like Grand Canyon or whatever, any of the official parks. I mean, this is on the registry now as a park, over.
Understand. Okay. Do you have another letter you think we should be reading, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Here's a question that I've been asked. I tried to explain this. This person says about a dipole. I want to put up a dipole, and I have had trouble in the past with even these center dipole connectors and insulators that they sell that I, like you, I'm near the ocean, and I find that no matter what I do, I get corrosion problems in the middle of the antenna, where the antennas come, the two wires come together to the feed point. What can you suggest to take care of this? I've had a few times even water migrated into the coax. There's several situations that can be, several ways it can be remedy this situation, and I know some of the people have told me a number of times that these center, you know, type of dipole support, for some reason, you know, they have a connector, a number of them on the bottom, you know, even the Ballum have that big screw on a PL 259 coax on the bottom, and no matter what they've done, water is migrated in, think over.
In the case of a Ballum, I think you could drill a very small leap hole to make sure that the water that got inside by condensation has a way to get back out. And if it's got a UHF connector on the bottom, when you wrap it with the right kind of rubberized tape and or spray it with the Scotch-Brite or something like that, you can do a medium good job of weatherproofing. It's not easy. When it comes to direct coax connection to the center of a dipole, there are ways of making the coax cable come up to the center insulator and loop over it. So there's a service loop where the open end of the coax is hanging back down. And I think you could coat the end of the coax with Celastic adhesive and do a medium good job of weatherproofing so that water doesn't crawl down the coax. I didn't say it's easy. And all the connections of the coax to the dipole itself, there's got to be the right kind of a service loop, so it's got the ability to swing back and forth without creating a fatigue failure. Good solder job is required. The way you feed the center of a dipole to keep the weather out if you're in a seashore environment, that's a bit of an art form. You're a block away from the sea. What do you do to seal up your dipoles, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
You should ask. Hi, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I've had my problems. So, for instance, I've a couple times used commercial balums, I guess that's the proper way to say it, balum. Putting that connector on the bottom, the UHF connector on there, and taping it, you know, and using that rubberized sealant, coax seal. It's a job. You really got to pull it and get it right. And even then, you could have problems because the weight of the cable hanging down and all. So I found a unique way of doing it. First of all, most of the time now, wherever I've used balums, it would have been homebrew. And what I've done is very interesting, very simple, too. I take a peanut butter jar. Actually, you know these plastic peanut butter jars, the big mouth on top with the plastic screw-on cap. And what I do, I make a hole on either side, and I bring the cable in, the two dipole ends, into the peanut butter jar. I put a piece of plexiglass inside there as the strain relief, or you'd say the center insulator. And then I bring the cover, from the cover, I put in the coax, goes right through the cover with a clamp. There is a clamp that's for the coax. It's a, you pass the coax, in other words, through this clamp and into the jar. You make all your connections now soldered up, whatever you solder everything. Now you close the lid of the jar and you tighten the clamp, Dick, over.
Okay. Since the clamp is on the inside of the jar, how do you get in there to tighten the clamp? Oh, I think I see what you're doing. Is it a hose clamp? And the hose clamp is clamping the coax to the center plexiglass insulator inside the jar. And you're doing all this through a hole on the outside. And where the wire goes through the holes for the side of the plastic peanut butter jar, are you then coating that with Celastic to weatherproof it? A couple more words are required here, Mel. Go ahead.
In other words, when the dipole is up, the cover of the jar is hanging downwards, you know, with the cable hanging downwards, as you would put any of the center insulators. Now, the connector, the strain relief connector, they sell these connectors. We use them extensively in the security field for outdoor cameras for the coax to come through. They come in a number of different sizes, but basically what they are is a... around a half-inch diameter. They have a nut on, they're made out of plastic, they have a nut that in other words, if you were securing it to a cabinet, you tighten the nut inside there. The cable then passes through the center of it. On the outside of it, there's another, another nut. It's, I don't know how to describe it, like it looks like it has a dome nut, and it has a hole in it, and what it does, as you're turning this outer nut, once the cable, everything is in place, as you're turning the outer nut, it squeezes onto the cable like fingers in there. In other words, the nut is like tapered, so it squeezes the fingers all together around that are inside this connector. It's similar to like a connector. I guess you could almost use a VX type connector, Dick, or a Romex connector, over.
Okay, I'm getting the picture. And what you're describing, those fingers that get squeezed down by the acorn nut with a hole in the center, I call that a collet mechanism. And the way you're squeezing down with those fingers to clamp onto the coax to hold it into position, that's going to work rather nicely with polyethylene coax, solid polyethylene coax. If a person made the mistake of doing that with foam-filled coax, I think the way the foam-filled coax flows, I don't think you'd get a good joint with that collet mechanism. What do you think, Mel? Go ahead.
Describe the exact collet. Well, we used it on coax cable. We used it on all different types of coax cable. I never seen any problem with it because it clamps it nice and evenly all around. You know, I could say when that thing comes together, it gives it an equal squeeze. So I don't know if you'd have very... I haven't had any problems, let's put it this way. I've been using the Belden, you know, which we shouldn't mention because, you know, things we've had controversy about Belden wire, but I've used Belden wire extensively because I got it, the price was right, of course. So the 9914 series or whatever the heck they call it. And I use this peanut butter jar method